Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are canceling unethical persuasion. I'm going to grab that verb. It's a trigger verb. We're going to do some canceling.
I love it.
This is about teaching people some new techniques for being able to talk to each other, be able to convert each other, you know, do the American thing, which is try to persuade people to different positions so that they'll vote for the things you want to vote for. And that's what I do. My name is Dr. Dan. I'm a American rhetorician, escaped professor, also late night comedy writer. And I started the Rhetoric Warriors brand to try to teach people some more sophisticated techniques for talking during complicated times. I talk to comedians, I convert people off their politics, and I bring in persuasion pros. So this week, we're revisiting an earlier conversation with Tom from Tacoma, who I guess is a conversion target. Most people, when I tell them that, are like, you can't convert me. And I'm like, probably not. But that doesn't stop me from trying. I may convert you 0.25%. You know?
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. I'm already extremely socially liberal. So you got a good base to build from.
Yeah, I think most people, you know, when you go in and you actually excavate their belief system, you know, it's very rarely just a solid block of adherence to one thing. You know, it's always got sort of, you know, squishy areas and, you know, things that they, almost everybody's had direct experience with, things that would move them off, you know, even on the liberal side. People that are super liberal, if they get a very hardcore experience with something, they lose some of that liberalness, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would say Tom, I got interested in working, talking to Tom, because we would talk a little bit about politics, which is very difficult to avoid these days. And I would trigger him, but he never really would tell me what he was getting triggered by. But I saw an intense triggerment, and I wanted to explore that because I always found that interesting. I think it's these kind of sore or areas of triggerness that allow us to figure out dialogue. And so I'm always interested in them. I would describe Tom, from my perspective, as an individualistic, an individualism person. Like, that's his theories and his sort of approach are to highlight the individual. And all the way back to Onion Ring, whatever her name is. Back into Reagan, we've talked about Reagan a little bit. And Tom, you know, kind of describes himself maybe as a little bit as a libertarian. But it's one of our problems with, we don't have a good political lexicon to capture a lot of people. So Tom from Tacoma, there he is, Tacoma Tom.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, you know, conversations, they have value, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So describe where you would describe yourself as your politics.
I've had, it's easy to describe yourself as not, right?
And, yeah, that's fine. You can start there.
Not a Trump guy. Definitely not a Biden guy.
That's interesting to me. Like, that people have a strong, like, I understand a strong aversion or reaction opinion of Trump, but Biden seems much more tapioca. Like, I don't see, why do you get a big reaction to him?
I was first introduced to Biden during the Supreme Court nomination confirmation hearings with Judge Bork. And I read about Judge Bork and I thought he was a fantastic choice for the Supreme Court. And Biden just was a freaking bulldog. And then started reading some about Biden and his political persuasions, where he was, you know, trying to de-junglefy Maryland and Baltimore. And, you know, he's a racist.
And come on, Biden.
Like, absolutely.
You can definitely find, like, if you go back and haul that stuff out of his background.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Like the plagiarism.
There's nothing about him right now
that stopped him from getting elected last time.
There's nothing about him right now that people, like, nobody has made that stick on him right now.
If you don't know history, you are bound to repeat it. And he is clearly a racist and clearly somebody that, doesn't have any scruples. I mean, he got busted for plagiarism. That's why he didn't get to the nomination last time he got close.
Okay. So let's, the great thing about rhetoric is that it allows us to have an apparatus for looking
at. All right, hang on. Now, you asked me a question and you stopped me before I even got there.
And I'll tell you why. Okay. I'll let you finish. But like one of the things that is a real challenge these days in political discussion, especially, is that we make so many claims so fast as we talk that we never get to go back and investigate any of those claims.
Okay.
And in rhetoric, like it's claims, evidence, rebuttal, warrant, which means now you've got a justifiable claim to conclusion. And so we'll come back to the Biden racist history, you know, plagiarism, you know, the sins of Biden.
Okay.
But go ahead and finish your overview.
I mean, I can make a long list of sins of Trump too. I mean, he's
politicians are sinful.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. You got to know that to begin with. Right. I think I'm very socially liberal and fiscally conservative in a way that neither party, you know, I call them the Republicrats because they have the same business model. You know, there's really not a spit's worth of difference between them. And I don't think either one is fiscally conservative or socially liberal. So I don't fit.
So they're not socially liberal enough for you, and they're not fiscally conservative enough for you.
I don't think either one's fiscally conservative, and you know, the Democrats make a claim to social, to being liberal or, you know, small L liberal when it comes to social issues, but their record doesn't say that.
Okay, so. Let's take some of these things that you've kind of laid out. You've given yourself two camps, and that's a traditional piece of rhetoric.
I admitted being schizophrenic right out of the chute.
Now, it's one of those, and you find this a lot in politics, that when good little pieces of script are generated somewhere, people will latch onto them and use them to describe themselves, because your political orientations and your beliefs in general are difficult to describe. So when you come up with a nice, you know, explanatory, prescriptive little piece of script, people use it. And that one, socially liberal, fiscally conservative, that's a little four-word pair that's become very popular.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Show me where those people are, because I'd like to join.
Well, you know, Schwarzenegger, that's how he describes himself.
Okay. Interesting. Don't know a lot about his politics, really. Not from that the People's Republic of California, but I suspect that you know, that's a piece, you know, that within his worldview and spectrum in California, that might be true, but I don't know that it would be absolutely true to you.
Determining truth in politics is a dicey game. So it's not always what I apply as the criteria for whether, you know, I think that somebody's a good person or whatever, but, or a good candidate or a good governor. But so like in California, that's a very familiar phrase, because California is socially liberal, you know, as a culture, you know, for a lot of reasons. I think it's one of the younger parts of the country. It's incredibly interpenetrated with cultures. I used to say you can't really be a racist in Los Angeles because you'd be exhausted. You know, like you don't even know what people are.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, you know, visually identify what somebody, their background is. So you don't know whether to hate them or not. It's like, I don't know. So it's a very socially liberal state, but it's got a strong history of fiscal conservatism, you know, like coming from Reagan, you know, all the way up.
No, he might have. I think I'd argue ending with Reagan. I can't think of any governor of California since Reagan that was paying attention to anything except, you know, spending. And I'm not sure Reagan had that kind of a, you know, I wouldn't argue it, but I'd be willing to bet that Reagan was, you know, the last of his breed there.
So let's talk about the fiscal conservative part of it. Like, and I know you're a student of history, and I know you've probably read some to give yourself some foundation in that principle of fiscal conservatism. So explain it to me a little bit, because finances are not really my area.
You know, I would say, you know, We talked a little bit about Ayn Rand. Von Hayek is from the Austrian school of economics, and maybe sort of one of the founders. Von Mises was another guy in there, but you know, they were on the front lines for, you know, the time from the end of the Second World War to the beginning, the end of the First World War to the beginning of the Second. And you know, they saw what happened when Von Hayek's book is called The Road to Serfdom, S-E-R-F, Serfdom.
Sounds like a bad and road.
Not a good road. It's not a good road. And it's a hard book to read. I finally gave up and did it on audio, and I still had a hard time getting through it. But and it was really about, you know, the bigger that the government gets, the more of your liberties that you've handed over to the government. And it's eventually you're a serf eating dirt, and the people that are running the government are the ones that, you know, have the gold. And I don't know if I can do his economic theory justice. I think he got a Nobel Prize for it back when they gave those to people that weren't part of the cancel culture. But it's been, it's a book from the 40s. And, I think that's sort of a pillar for me is that. And Ayn Rand had a similar thing, right? She was a Jew in Russia when the Bolsheviks took over, and basically just took her family house and took her, you know, bourgeois middle class belongings, and, you know, put her dad in the concentration camp, and she walked out of Russia in the wintertime. And she saw what happened when, again, you give up personal liberties in exchange for some security from the state. So I think both of those are, you know, sort of the cautionary tales of when you're not fiscally conservative.
Well, let's see. Let's see if we can connect these things a little bit. So fiscal conservatism, I see that as money policy. It sounds like you're tying it up with sort of civil liberties policies.
Well, that's what these two authors said, is eventually you get to where you've lost your civil liberties when you continue to turn over responsibility for yourself to the state. So I guess this comes back to my individualism streak, right? I'm going to make decisions for me. I'm going to make the best decisions I can. If I want to be selfish or greedy or whatever, I can do that. And by the way, I trust you to make the best decisions for you. And I don't claim that I can decide better than you can for you, right?
So yeah, this is a really interesting point. I had a conversation with somebody about this the other day. You're of the theory that people are fine or should be empowered, that it's a workable system if they are in charge of themselves.
I think that's what the founding fathers of the United States said. And I think they're pretty sharp guys, so I agree with that.
Yeah, but you're not doing this because of the founding fathers. You're doing this because you believe it.
I don't know. I think your beliefs are really sort of what you've been taught and what you've learned from what you've been taught. I've read the Constitution. It's an incredible document. And I think I told you last time, I've been reading about the time that led up to the Constitution from the, you know, sort of the 1500s.
Yeah. Wild times.
It was amazing. I learned so much when I read this. It's just incredible. I think that Age of Enlightenment and the Smith's Invisible Hand and some of the writing that Locke did and this influenced the guys that founded the country. And by the way, they were rich. They were the richest people in the colonies. They were slaveholders. Hamilton was just a real son of a bitch. You know, these guys were human in a big way. But what they wrote down and what they aspired to for all of us is pretty incredible. So I'm saying I learned about that. And I think that my own reading of that is what, you know, kind of animates me and my views.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. Most people don't dive back in to actually read the original text, get a real sense of, you know, what the colonial, you know, Congress and, you know, all that kind of stuff was, and the depth of intellectualism, pretty strong, you know,
yeah,
in that world.
Pretty incredible.
So do you apply this idea to your life? Like the context that I was talking to my friend the other day about this was he's a stoic and an individualist and
stoic,
you know, really strong guy, strong-minded guy, works hard to be a good person. And was talking about how he's got three little kids and he's trying to, you know, give these kids the same values. Like he's trying to show them the value of being able to take care of your own stuff, having your own power in the world and all that. And I'm like, well, that sounds like you're handing that down to somebody else. You know, like you are determining this for them because you think it's the right thing, which doesn't seem like to be in line with your individualism theory. Like you're taking a strong hand. You are being a strong government to your children.
Yeah. Well, it's not a democracy here. It is a dictatorship. And absolutely. But I mean, you're a dad. I'd ask you, how does that turn out?
It turns out very well. Like I use no power with my kids whatsoever.
Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah. I did not do a command and control model with my children.
Oh, well, I meant they're not allowed to burn the house down. They're not allowed to, you know, shoot their eye out, you know, that kind of thing. I'm not. Otherwise, I think they're pretty, you know, from a young age, we let them pick their own socks and clothes, right? And they were horribly mismatched. You know, and people go, oh my God, these people, it's horrible what they do to this child. Kids loved it. Eventually, well, you know what, though? My 18-year-old was home from school and she was wearing two different color socks the other day on purpose.
That's awesome. There's the socially liberal part of your, that's Ayn Rand on somebody's feet. Right
yeah.
there.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Make your own well, maybe, maybe, but she's not cut out of the same cloth as I am for sure, politically. And she's not animated by what's going on in the world. You know, she wants to be a genetic engineer, a researcher in a lab. And she's some things just don't enter into her world. Mm-hmm. So well, me, it's hard to find something I don't have an opinion about.
That's, you know, that's kind of been one of the pleasures of being an American is we have not had to pay attention to politics. Politics has been allowed to be boring and, you know, kind of shoved off to the side of like, well, when we have to do it, we'll do it because the country's run so well generally. You know, it wasn't until, you know, again, the last 4 years when you saw somebody come in like Trump, it was very different ways of doing government that people are suddenly like, hey, maybe we're going to have to pay attention to this.
Yeah. You know? Maybe. Although I would argue that we've had three of the worst presidents the country has ever seen in a row, and the country's still pretty good. And I'm not putting Biden in there yet, although I have my expectations for how his turns out. So I go back to the structure and the founding fathers. You know, it's funny when somebody says gridlock's so terrible. I'm like, well, you should read your history because that's what they wanted. And it's designed for gridlock. Perfect. Nothing gets done. We don't lose any liberties.
Actually, I was reading something. Anyway, we'll come back to that. I want to make sure we.
I keep taking you off. You know, I did a good job of letting you kind of lead the conversation last time. I'm wound up this time, so sorry about that.
No, it's totally cool. Like, there's no agenda here. So, all I'm trying to do is explore things, and when I find something interesting, sometimes I'll circle back around because I know it's not been fully gleaned yet.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and so I think this sense of like families are a good place to look at politics. Like people don't think about their families, you know, as political systems, but you can, you know, and essentially, like you said, it's a dictatorship versus a democracy. And for some reason, American, you know, families like this idea that they can be a monarchy or a dictatorship inside of a family structure. And like, who empowered you with that? Who gave you that right?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, you have to tell me more about that. I think, you know, legally, for most of our history, children have been property. And I'm responsible for that property until it's 18, you know, and I definitely want to give it a good start and a good foundation and keep them from burning somebody else's house down because then I'd be responsible, right? But
yeah, and they're the extremes. Yeah,
combination
like that.
Of both. Couldn't you make the argument, though, that a family is really sort of the ultimate in socialism or communism? Everything's everybody's and, you know, everybody, you know, you end up with some tragedy of the commons where, you know, the freaking dishes don't get done until dad goes, we're into somebody to the dishes, right? But, I mean, you can make an argument both ways, I think.
Yeah. And I think they are. I mean, you can't be, this is one of the problems with importing business, you know, into politics, which is one of the things, you know, that you get with Trump is that he's a business guy and he imports some of that over here. The problem being that, you know, a lot of the things that work in business don't work in social situations. Like you can't fire somebody from your family, you know, when you get displeased with them or you don't like their results, you know?
Well, I don't know. You should hang out with some Armenians, because I think, you know, that's probably quite possible, but.
I've seen it. I had a girlfriend in college who was Italian from New Jersey, and, you know, I'm from Kentucky, and I went up and spent a few days with her one summer with her Italian family. And while I was there, the dad disowned the 17-year-old boy and threw him out of the house. And I'm like,
oh, wow,
you can do that? And she's like, he'll be back. But, you know, families are a good place to ground some of this theory. And that's kind of one of the things I try to do when you're looking for, well, what is the good system here? Like, are we making good choices or not? If you can move it around a little bit and get a different perspective, sometimes people, the ideas come a lot more clear. And with me, with families, like I said, with my kids, I never did power. I never told them no. Like, I never used dominance with my kids.
Oh, well, that's not how it is here.
Yeah. And it's not that way in most places.
Ultimately, I'm deciding.
Right. But to me, like,
or their mom's deciding, right?
So one of the courses that I'll be launching at some point is persuasion for parents, like how to be a persuasive parent. Because if you know persuasion, you don't need to use dominance. But if you don't know good persuasion, then you fail. Bad persuasion with kids is like letting them engage in a debate. You know, they can't do it very well. It goes off the rails. They get too much power. But if you give them a limited debate, a very limited, like, okay, I know you want to do this. You can do this or this. So let's talk about which one you want. Then they get trained to that system. They have power. And whenever there's conflict, they know this is the system that's going to be used. And you can't, as soon as you interrupt it with dominance or power, they don't trust it anymore and it's gone.
I think that, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I know in practice, having brought up 2.5, let's say it, and I got 4, 2 still at home, really. That works until it's late and you're tired and you go, hey, this is how it's going to be. I think that's a wonderful way to program your kids appropriately. And I think the last thing I want to do anyway is raise rule followers. You know,
especially as an individualistic individualist, the last thing you want is to be imprinted upon another human being to the point where they can't find themselves in there.
Yeah. I mean, I've always tried to say, look, you know, I want you guys to think for yourself, right? I want you to go gather information and make your own decisions, learn how to make good ones. And by the way, you're never going to have all the information when you have to decide. And if you don't decide, that's still a decision, you know? And so you kind of, you can see those gears turn. We'll see how it turns out. I mean, you don't get really a good manual for kids anyway. So
no, you don't.
Don't know how bad you've broken them until you're on your deathbed.
Well, and you know, I tell my kids they've been 20-year experiments by a rhetorician. You know, it was designed. I knew exactly what I was doing, and I've watched the results. So, and I was lucky. I had good clay. They're both smart kids, good people. And then they go to their moms, and they were, you know, it was a different system there. She used much more, you know, dominance and command and control. Yeah. And so, you know, those two systems kind of warred in our family where they would, you know, come to me and I'm not loose. Like my world is very structured over here because I like structure. You know, I don't like things sort of satelliting off into their own and causing trouble over here and whatever. But I get it in a different way than she does. Like I would never overtly command, this is the way it's going to be. And she did that all the time. So they get a little of both.
Yeah.
A lot of both.
Good. A lot of both. Good for them.
So the idea of individualism, like when you start applying it, it makes sense to you. Like you can apply it to yourself fairly cleanly. I think most people would value, hey, I want freedom. I want the power to make my own decisions. Most people would super value that, especially in America.
Oh, Yeah, absolutely. And well, everybody, I'll argue everybody, you know, the most liberal capital L folks, they don't want anybody to tell them what to do. Just tell all those other idiots what to do.
That's right? One of my favorite things about America. It's like, don't tell me, I don't want anybody to tell me what to do, but I don't like what they're doing, so make them stop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true of both. That's true of both of, you know, both the Republicrats.
Yeah, it's true of every human being on the planet. It's true of every organism on the planet. I mean, we're born into a situation where you're born into an ecology. And this is one of the things I talk about with rhetoric and persuasion. You're born into an ecology where there are other things in your ecology and you have to influence them. Like if they want to take a bite out of you, you got to make sure that they are dissuaded from that. Mm. You know, if you want to eat this one over here, you have to figure out how to make that happen. So we are constantly having to figure out influence structures by being on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like right now we've got a virus that has decided that it wants to inhabit some of our space. And we're like, I don't really think we should let the virus do that.
I don't either. You know, I was reading this series of books I told you about on American history and looking at what happened, you know, when the plague would run through London and you know, people willingly got on small wooden boats and took 3-week journeys across the, you know, the Atlantic Ocean and landed in the middle of who knows what and tried to survive. And the survival rate for these early colonies, like the 1600s, it had to be on the order of 20%.
Wow. Yeah.
Because some of them there were some folks that Raleigh dropped off or Raleigh's guys dropped off on Roanoke Island, where it'd be North Carolina now, called the Lost Colony. They went back the next year to bring in some stuff and there was nobody. and the pilgrims, I mean, holy shit. I don't know how you can read that story and not believe in God, but there was, you know, there was only 5 deaths on the way over on the 80 people. Then they thought that was great. The pilgrims brought their own food. They didn't eat the food that the ship, you know, ship guys ate.
Those pilgrms. They had a
those pilgrims.
So individualism located in the individual, like I think you're right. Almost nobody would argue against that.
Mm.
Like pump it up as much as possible. We want as much freedom and power as we can get.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the hard part is saying and acting in a way that makes sure that that's applied to other people. And I think this is probably what I mentioned to you before about Reagan. I mean, he was a guy that had faith and he had faith in people and was, hey, they're going to make the right decision. Let them make the right decision. And I think that's the hard part, right? That's the leap of faith, right? Where you've got to just say, hey, they're going to make the right decision. Now, doesn't mean I'm not going to be able to protect myself when they come over the hill and decide to take my house or my car or whatever. But, you know, I think that's ultimately my responsibility.
So if they all made the decision, you know, to be, you know, non-propertied, and get rid of the concept of property, you would say, yeah, well, they all made that decision, so that was their right.
I would say that that's what our founding fathers called the tyranny of the majority. And part of the reason they designed a system where the majority would have a real hard time making that happen. Checks and balances, you know, independent parts of government that have independent powers. That's the tyranny of the majority, right? And that is a real issue. I mean, that's essentially what happened. That's what happened with Hitler, right? I mean, he was elected.
He was a minority. He was a minority party. He was tyranny of the minority that then took over the majority.
I don't know. I think maybe there was a lot of people that thought what he was saying originally was good. And then they realized how ugly it was. And they were like, holy shit, how do we get out of this? But you don't get a whole country to go along unless people are, maybe. And this guy's saying something. And by the way, the last guys, we were eating dirt and sticking our head in the oven, trying to kill ourselves with, you know, the gas. So.
Yeah. Germany was, you know, not Shangri-La. It wasn't too hard for, you know, somebody to come in there and say, hey, I can make things better.
Yeah.
And people go, yeah, well, maybe, you know, give this guy a shot. He sounds crazy as shit, but nothing else is working.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, not students of history.
So let's stay on the, like, just the pure concept of individualism, because the crazy thing about abstract concepts with human beings, when you start applying them into situations, they fragment horribly.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, so this concept, again, very strong, and America, you know, is based in a lot of ways on the concept of individualism, or at least very small-ism.
Very small-ism, yeah. Well, I mean, I think better decisions made by smaller groups, right? It was the United States of America, not the United political subdivisions of America. You know, it was countries. Right?
And the United Countries built, of America.
That's what states means, exactly. They were countries. And, you know, that was from the very beginning. You know, the people that came to the U.S. were thinking about their right of self-determination and to write their own laws and, you know, make it apply. And it applied kind of on a city-by-city level.
So you let people do that.
I think closer to home, better. The closer to the big decisions are to home, the better.
That's a theory. Okay. So yeah, we can take that as a claim. Like, do you get better decisions by giving people local power, or do you get better decisions? So we go back to, like, you go back to the Greeks at this point, like Aristotle, you know, was very much an individualist, you know, that's very much about everybody, you know, figure out themselves, work hard to understand it and go from there. And Plato was the idealist. And he said, you get better decisions if you have really great people like the founding fathers, who you give room to be collectives, these kind of ruler kings, and they make great decisions because people on the local level don't know enough to really make good decisions.
Plato said this.
This binary now, you know, and it's very strong in American politics, you know, about do we get enough wisdom from local, barely informed sometimes people, or from, you know, high up, very informed, very, you know, experienced national people.
I think I'm going to say that's more of a human condition than an American condition. But I want to take you back to your premise. I've learned a little bit about rhetoric with you, Dr. Dan. You said giving people the power. And see, that's exactly upside down in my view. The people have the power. The people give the power to government. And if you think of it in terms of the government owning the power, then the people are serfs. You know, whoever's in charge of the government, whether it's divine right of kings, you know, some hereditary pass down, or it's the guy that bought the most votes. You know, if you think of it in terms of somebody had to give me the power, I think I've already lost.
Okay, I think that's fair. But let's look at, well, again, we go into a new concept, power. Power is going to exist in an ecology.
Absolutely. Right? Yep.
So apparently you distrust government to have any power.
Or that I didn't say zero. I made the claim that I wanted local. I want to be able to look the guy in the eye that's trying to make decisions for me. And I'm, you know, I think that's a human condition, right?
Yeah, for sure.
That humans know 250 people. You know, 250 people come to a funeral, 250 people come, you know, 500 come to a marriage, whatever, you know, there's like, that's sort of where it got, you know, where you couldn't manage it, right? So yeah, I'd rather it was smaller.
Okay. So that's a political philosophy, smallism, you know, we can look at. I'm curious though, like, you're in some ways valorizing, I don't think in some ways, you definitely valorize the founding fathers, right?
Okay. I said that they were messed up humans also, didn't I?
Sure. I'm not saying, okay. When I say valorize, I don't mean you think they're perfect.
Okay. But
you think they were smart guys. They worked hard about this. They put a moral document together that has real value.
I think it was hard to find another document like that in human history.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It was the first time all those things came together in one place. So, but that was a group of kind of super guys, right?
In some respects, yeah. I mean, like, yeah. I mean, look at, like, you know, I'm a big fan of John Adams. I mean, he spoke six languages, and his son spoke more. You know, yeah. He was a lawyer that lived in a little tiny house, like 20 miles horse ride from Boston.
So those guys, that kind of goes against your small local determination that you're going to pull your theory, your big theory set about government and the way we should organize things from this super, you know, that's Platonist. That's a Platonist ideal of get your smartest people together, do their best work, and then everybody can siphon off from that. Everybody can use that great work to organize their lives.
Yeah.
But that's not, that's the opposite flow from what your other let people decide here in little groups system is.
I don't know. I mean, it's
intellectually top down.
I think as long as I'm the one that gets to decide whether I think they're smart guys or good guys, then I don't see the conflict that you're pointing out. Right. As long as the individual does.
Yeah. Not saying that it's essentially a conflict. It's just that when you are trying to run your life on theory.
Yeah. Well,
that's a challenge.
Absolutely. And I think I try to find the theory that best fits my ability to run it, you know, run my life. You know, back to that point about, hey, I want to make all my own decisions. Let's stop those folks because they're dummies. Well, unless they're trying to take my house or abuse my kids or whatever, what they do is up to them.
And that's okay. So let's shift over to that one. That's a fairly safe, like easy standpoint to take. But what do you do when like that group of people over there becomes the Germans and are doing stuff that's so heinous that for you to just go, well, they're not doing it to me.
I think there's a point where you have to take up arms.
I mean, for other people's benefit, but it has nothing to do with you. Like,
well, the U.S. has done that twice in this century, right? I mean, it really wasn't our fight on the First World War, and it wasn't really our fight on the Second, but we kind of jumped in and made the difference. So I think maybe the country was a lot more uniform then. You know, I think it's a challenge when there's a draft, right? I mean, that's hard, right? The government's going to say you got to go to war.
That's a tough one.
But we don't have a draft anymore, right? And I think despite the ascendancy of the military in our culture today, it's great that we don't have a draft. You don't have to go be in the military if you don't want to. But you might sign up because you wanted to go, you know, fight the bad people or whatever.
So when you look at and I think, again, most people would agree with your position of it's great to run your own life. You should have the power as long as, you know, you got to trust people to make their own decisions, that kind of stuff. But are human beings uniformly enough across the species qualified to make their own decisions? Like you have a whole bottom layer here, one third or whatever, that probably are not. And then maybe some another third in the middle that are mixy or it's dicey. And then maybe a third that are pretty clear-minded can probably make an intellectualized decision. Yeah. But a lot of people over here, like if you're an addict, for example, do you want them to making their own decisions about things?
You know, I think there's certainly some balance in the liberties that you're willing to turn over, but you know, I can take those words you just used just a little further and say, you know what, people that have got that color skin, they shouldn't be able to vote. Bullshit. You know, the problem with that, what you just said, is somebody's got to decide. Mm-hmm. Who's going to decide whether the bottom third is, you know, knuckleheads? Who's going to decide that? Eventually, that judge is the one that has the power, right? It's the corollary of the golden rule. Guy with the rules makes the gold, and that's what scares me, is when somebody gets to decide that kind of thing. And I just assume that there was a lot of kind of impediments to them getting in charge.
Well, I think there always are.
Because I don't think I can decide. I don't try to decide for other people.
But there are always impediments. Like there's no such thing as you know, pure power that somebody just gets to decide across the board for an entire group, you know, without blowback. Human beings don't work that way.
Yeah.
There's always controls.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the more controls, the better.
So you are for controls then.
Absolutely. I think the constitutional controls are awesome. You could also call me a constitutionalist if you want.
That's a really interesting rhetoric to me these days. I've got another conservative friend of mine. Not that you're conservative, but she does what
fiscally
I would
conservative.
Call, huh? Fiscally
conservative.
FC, not all C.
Right.
So she does this kind of, and I've seen a lot of it rise up in the last, you know, this sort of, especially within the Trump movement and the Tea Party movement, it's constitutionalism, you know, instead of being like wrapped in sort of the rhetoric of individualism or, you know, things like that, or even Christianity, it wraps everything in the terms of the Constitution. This originalism, this, you know, again, the valorization of the founding fathers and their intent and all that kind of stuff.
Maybe
it's a rhetoric.
I mean, I guess, yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. It is. I guess I'd say, you know, I didn't say originalist, right? I think women should be able to vote. I don't think there should be slavery. Right.
So you got they got those two wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. But they also left us a way to change it. It was hard to change, but they left us a way to change it. And we've fought wars over it. Right. So, like I said, I think it's hard to find another document, and that's why I honor it, because the process of developing it was certainly politics, but it seems to rise above just about any other sort of congress of people. I mean, think about the process and the people that made the modern Bible. Ooh, there's some stuff in there I don't think really was what that Hebrew, you know, the.
Yeah, there was some sneaking here and there.
Yeah, I don't think that's what Jesus was talking about. Just my take.
Well, and when I look at things because of rhetorician training, I look at things basically as language systems and these sort of very strong subsystems of language. And so constitutionalism, if you drag me over to there and we start talking about, you know, constitutionalism, then it's one set of responses and one way of doing that conversation. If we're over here on individualism, then it's basically individualism versus collectivism, right? Those are the two strongest concepts. And there's middle ground in between, which is where we really live, which is we have a bunch of individualism, but you also have to have a bunch of collectivism. There's no way around it. You're in a family. They have to have power. They have to have efficacy. They have to have, you know, the ability to make mistakes and get away with it. And all those things have to be there in a collective. You can't have one dominant individual and, you know, four people just satelliting around them, you know, and you can't have five individuals. They are a collective.
But I'd argue there's never been a collective because one of them is going to be dominating, more dominating than the others.
In certain ways, it's got so much flow, right? And so much dialectic to it. Sometimes you have power, sometimes you don't. Some areas they take ascendancy, some areas they don't. And there's going to be a certain age when
theory. I think that's a theory you're going to have a hard time applying either on a small scale or a big one.
What, that you, that power changes within collectives?
That within a collective, there's a fair process for sharing power.
I never said there was fair. I just said there is a process.
Oh, there's a process. So even if I'm, you know, being marched off to be shot and my family's going to have to pay for the bullets, then I've still got some chance that I'm going to get to be in power. Maybe not.
Well, again, now you're moving me out of family and you're moving me up into communities and societies and things like that. And okay. Every time you go up and elevate to bigger collectives, yeah. You get a new set of issues, right?
Okay. I'm with you.
So with you. That's why, like, you know, we start with the atom of the individual and as we explore this idea and they're like, okay, well, we haven't even hit the dyad yet. Like in a marriage, are you an individual in a marriage?
I'm I think that's where collectivism begins, right?
Yeah, you try that's to be the, an individual that's the, that's, in a marriage.
Didn't work out too good for me.
It's a tough stance. That's a tough one.
Absolutely. That is a tough one. Absolutely. Now we're getting a little, this is a little scary for me. I'm triggered again, Dad.
Oh, yeah. Is that because you think like every theory, the reason why people grab onto theories is they do good things for you, is what you would hope in life. You know, you end up believing about something because you think this is the best chance I have for being happy and doing good things and avoiding, you know, all the pain and bullshit that I don't want to deal with in life. And so, you know, I think when people pick a good theory and it works out well for them, it's fun to watch. Like, I find that really satisfying. Mm. And then when you see people pick a bad theory and just it wrecks their life over and over again, and you're like, dude, this is why my whole thing is, like, when you learn rhetoric, you get a set of tools for trying to go in and do a little mechanic work on people. And it should be on things that are causing problems. It shouldn't be dragging them away from good things. That's why I would never take individualism away from people. I'm a incredible individualist. I love just being by myself and running my own stuff. Like, it's great, but it's an illusion. Like, human beings have not been able to do this very much in the time we've been on this planet.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think we're wired to be, you know, absolutely alone, right? I don't think I was making that claim. I'm saying this theory, to me, a theory is more like a scientific, you know, you come up with a theory that best fits and explains something that you're seeing, right? And to me, this, you know, my approach kind of best fits the, you know, the idea where the most people are doing better over time, as opposed to being ground into dirt and eaten by their, you know, their betters, right? So I guess that's, you know, my approach is that theory is kind of the, you know, starts with your observations. And you accused me of this before, where I was abductive was the word of the day.
Yeah, an abductive thinker.
Yes, thank you. I'm gonna wear that as a badge of honor.
I'm an abductive thinker. You know, deductive thinkers have to be given all the information, all the rules, all the theory, and they can apply it well. Inductive thinkers are a little more individualistic in that they don't need the top down stuff. They want to look at it themselves, come up with strong rules, and then they have a theory. Abductives are creative, and they'll grab stuff from anywhere and just use it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is, you know, that's one of the reasons why I enjoy doing things like this, talking to people from whatever perspective, is because I know I'm going to hear things in there that I can grab and make use of. And rhetoricians don't really care about whether something's correct or not. Ultimately, one of the Occam's razors for rhetoricians is, does this make people happy? Does this make me happy? Does it make the people that I'm interacting with happy? Like, what is the best outcome that this theory is going to get? It doesn't matter what the theory is, but what outcome does it actually get?
Yeah.
And you've pulled this a few times out, like you have pulled socialism or collectivism out as like a boot heel on your, you know, the collective throat of mankind, of taking you out and shooting you and charging you for the bullet.
Yeah.
When did you get such a down, you know, perspective on the collective power?
I don't know.
Have you been subjected to collective power somewhere along the line that you're like, oh, I'll never do that again?
No. I don't know. It's interesting. You know, one of my daughters was had to do a debate for school, right? She's on the debate team. And the topic was, you're going to love this. This is the ultimate kind of, let's whitewash this and change the name, right? Like Orwell, right? So the topic was universal basic income. Okay. And I'm just listening, Dan. I wasn't involved in it. She comes to me and she says, it did trigger me. And I was like, oh boy, what a kind of deprogramming am I going to have to do after this? Right. But it was debate. So she had to take both sides. So she comes to me after about a week of working on it. And she goes, you know, I've got some really good examples for the against, right? I can look at, I can certainly look at Russia and the Bolsheviks. I can look at the National Socialist Party in Germany, where that went. I can look at Zimbabwe over the last 20 years. I can look at Venezuela over the last 20 years. I got some great why you shouldn't do it examples. How am I going to do the other side? Fuck, this is hard. I was hoping she was going to come to me and ask me about the other. And I said, oh, well, I got it. I know exactly how to do it. It's all emotion. Just go for emotion. Isn't it terrible that people are, don't have exactly what they want? Isn't it awful? And think about how heartrending that is. And then I'm not doing a good job of it now, but at the time I felt like I did a really good job of just take the emotion and run with it. And that was your best argument. And I guess, I don't know, just that maybe, you pointed out earlier, says something about it. I love history and I've read a lot about it, and just seems like I'm seeing a trend.
It's an interesting question, when people take on socialism and communism and, again, in rhetoric, you have epideictic.
Progressivism,
innovation, liberalism, reasonableness, all these terms.
Now you're mixing and matching.
But when you, in rhetoric, you have three traditions, really. It's epideictic rhetoric, which is praise and blame, which is big judgments about the good and bad of something. And then there's forensic rhetoric, which goes in and takes things apart for about, this is kind of the truth rhetoric. Like, if we're taking this apart, we're doing forensics on it. I need to bring you through my forensic process so that you go, oh yeah, I think that's correct. And then there's deliberative rhetoric, which is both sides get to do their forensics and their epideictics, and they just war in the middle until one side, everybody's like, yeah, that's a better side.
What was the first one called?
Epideictic.
Epideictic.
Weirdest word in there, but like, when you look at the epideictics and the forensics of socialism and communism, and I'm neither. I'm not really even political, which is always interesting because I came into this from Trump, from the angle of Trump, but socialism and communism have never been allowed to be what they are in the world without capitalism and monarchism and dictatorism and all these other things surrounding it.
Maybe.
So you've never really seen an example of it in the world.
If only we had more power, we could have made it work.
Maybe. Like, if you think, just add one little thing to that statement, because I totally get why you think like that. And I think a lot of people do. Don't trust people who want to come in and have power over you, period. Right?
Make a good deal, and you know what the deal is.
But you don't like the idea of people having power over you. You don't trust it. You've seen it go badly. You don't want that system. But, it's like good king, bad king. If you have a great king, you want that king to live forever.
Monarchy is a great thing.
It's like, we are doing awesome under this king.
Yeah.
Then, his son comes along, you're like, this is the worst king ever.
Yeah.
So monarchies can be absolute amazing or absolutely devastating. Same way of emperors and all those systems. And it's almost like you described democracy as like, let's stay eternally broken so nobody can ever have power to really become good king or bad king.
Like that summary. Let's not, because it, by the way, I think democracy has brought more people out of poverty and changed more lives for the positive than anything else. Right. I mean, you look at, going away from slavery, going, from just an agrarian nation to the world's industrial superpower. I think that happens because of democracy. So I don't know if I'm going to go quite as far as, I don't want there to be any centralization of power but I do think democracy gives you opportunities that, you just don't get in other systems.
Yeah. And every system, human beings struggle with this constantly. What is our good system for these type of people in these conditions? And, any system can be bad if it has bad leaders, and probably any system can be good if it has good leaders.
Yeah.
So maybe it comes down to us training better leaders.
Well, I think reading history is a good place to start.
Yeah. Right. I agree with that. Well, cool. This has been fun. Once again, I enjoy these conversations.
Are you? Hey, I'd love to do one of these where you and I are both there and we get to talk to somebody. So if that opportunity presents itself, I'm in for a threesome.
Oh, like if we're trying to pull this person to our perspectives, that'd be fun.
I'm not going to fit. You got to have another person that's trying to pull them, you know, right or left in the regular spectrum, but I'll just be the guy throwing the hand grenades.
Well, I think you have a strong perspective. I don't think it aligns on that political linear system, you know, so well, but it's clearly strong ideas, and you're going to give, you know, you would vote hard. You would vote strongly.
Yeah. I've wasted a lot of votes too. Yeah.
Well, that's you know, democracy, it's broken. There's a lot of flaw in it.
Yeah.
And you're making decisions about people you don't get to meet from a million miles away with no other real good options around you. So it's got its limits.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
Well, again, this is fun. I appreciate it very much. We will circle back around. Anything that you need to say to people before we leave?
No, Dan, I appreciate the engagement, and I learn every time I talk to you, and I'm just thrilled to, you know, have had the opportunity to be on with you again.
Cool. Well, this is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Go over to Rhetoric Warriors, take a class or two. You know, I have a class in converting conservatives, and I'll have the next one is converting liberals, because I like to be balanced. You know, that's what life's all about, is balance. Learn a few things. You'll find out this stuff is actually doable if you got some of the software and technology to do conversions on people. I'll see you next time on Rhetoric Warriors podcast.